Most of us in sales appreciate a good comeback story. You know, the stories where you have this person who's up against incredible odds, they're able to turn it completely around and rise to the top. Now today I'm going to take you through my personal story. And when I say my personal story, I promise you this, we're not going to be talking a bunch of like motivational rah-rah type stuff. I'm going to take you through the exact tactics that I use to go from 60th out of 375 sales reps all the way up to 12th worldwide and then promoted to run a region with 150 employees. My name is Paul Castain, and I'm the author of the Your Sales Playbook blog and your host for the Sales Playbook podcast. I've personally trained over 10,000 sales reps, sales leaders, and business owners to sell more. So get your playbooks ready because school is now in session. So when you heard me mention that I had been ranked 60th, out of 375 sales reps worldwide. And shortly before that, I mentioned how we love these stories where people had all these things against them and they defied the odds and all that. You're probably thinking, like, how in the hell is being ranked 60th out of 375 having everything against you? Well, we really have to go back to where the story begins. And the story begins a year earlier than that. And it was 1995. And I had just lost my business. And I lost my business for the worst possible reason. And it's the same reason why many of you are not doing as good as you could be in sales. And this is why I'm so passionate about this part of becoming that aspiring sales rock star. I lost my business because, and they're really joined at the hip, being extremely arrogant and being this old dog, meaning that you could not teach me a new trick. I knew it all. I was the first one in a crowd to say, that's sales 101, and yet I wasn't doing it. I wasn't doing anything to get smarter. I wasn't open to feedback from anyone. And next thing you know, Uncle Paul loses his business. It was a devastating blow to me and my family because not only did I lose the business, but I had both my cars repossessed. I was $60,000 in debt. I went from earning about in, I would say, 1994, having made about $140,000, somewhere around there, which isn't a bad income today. But back then, man, that was even more money if you think about it, cost of living and everything. And I went from that to having to work a night job for $8.50, running a press again, going back to my roots to support my family. I also, you know, I go from business owner, somebody who's known in the local community as a business owner, to my second job was delivering pizza and waiting tables and stuff. So it was quite humiliating for me. And I was not only financially just really bankrupt because I was 60 grand in debt. I was emotionally bankrupt. So it starts there. So there I am. I'm working my night job. And I had really given up. I'm going to be real straight up honest with you. I had given up. And I kind of thought that maybe, okay, this is where I'm really destined to be, right? I suck at what I do. I'm obviously a horrible salesperson. I'm not destined to own a business and everything. And I'd work these long 12-hour shifts. It was from 8 p.m. at night till 8 in the morning. And I did that 3 to 4 days a week. And sometimes I'd do some overtime and stuff. And it was just, it was brutal. It really was. I mean, you talk about sleep deprived and emotionally when you're not getting your sleep, man, I remember being an emotional wreck and just, I'm not like a crier. And I remember at that point, just like being so depressed and sleep deprived that like, just like breaking down and crying. Not, thank goodness, not in front of people, but like just really, I was just a wreck. And I remember getting to the point where I was like, all right, enough already. You know, I've gotten my ass handed to me. You know, the bully kicked the shit out of me in the playground and not only kicked the shit out of me, but kind of paraded me around with a wedgie, you know, to kind of like, you know, humiliate me. And now it was time to believe in myself again and get back you know, after my dreams and everything, which is very hard to do when you just got that kind of ass kicking. So that's what I mean by against the odds. So I went job hunting. I found a situation that was ideal for me. The base salary in and of itself was humiliating next to what I had made. The base salary back then was like $19,500. But it had a really aggressive commission plan. And that spoke to me because I had something to prove at this point. And I figured, you know, this is ideal for me. I would love a high salary, but I need something that's going to keep me out there hunting every single day. So this is now where the tactics come into place. This is what I started to do. So the very first thing was I needed to do some stuff with my mindset, and I needed to stop reflecting on the failure that I just had. Now, that should resonate with some of you, because some of you are coming off of bad months or a bad period of time. Maybe you've had a bad several months. Maybe, you know, you've lost a significant chunk of your business, right? So I needed to stop beating myself up, and I kind of needed to forgive myself and just say, all right, enough of that shit already. I mean, you know, I could sit here. I don't want to be that guy in the bar 30 years from now telling the story about who I used to be, right? I didn't want to be that has-been. So one of the mindset things that I did came from a friend of the family's who was a multimillionaire. And he had given me a pep talk. And he said, you know, Paul, he knew me my whole life, by the way. And he said, you had all these hopes and dreams and stuff like that. Now more than ever, after, you know, you've gotten this ass kicking, you need them again. And, you know, we talked and everything. And the thing that I had really wanted in my life at that, even before that point, especially, was I had little children. I mean, you know, my oldest at that point was about 2 years old. We had another baby on the way. And I really wanted someday to be able to take this family of mine to Disney. So his advice was, get a picture of the Magic Kingdom, keep it on your desk, and use that as your goal. So now what I did was I took a picture of the Magic Kingdom with the castle and everything, and I kept it on my desk now as I started this new job. So every time somebody would hang up on me, I would look at that picture and say, screw this, you're not going to deprive me of this. I wouldn't say it to the person on the phone, but that's what I'd kind of say to myself so I could pick up the phone again. When I'd get a deal that came through, I would look at that castle and I'd say, I'm a little bit closer to getting there, getting my family there. Like there was this great journey and I was moving us on this journey toward that magic castle. And when I had a bad day, I would look at that picture and I started envisioning my family there. And as like a few years progressed and everything, I started imagining, now we have a little girl at this point, she's a few years old, I started picturing her as a princess standing in, you know, dressed up as a princess standing in front of the Magic Kingdom, and there's our family and everything. And not to fast forward and give you a spoiler alert, but it was about 11 years later that we not only cleared up all our debt and all the sins of the past and everything, got our life completely on track and everything, that I was able to bring my family there for real. And it so happened that my daughter was really into Beauty and the Beast at the time. So the picture that I have that reminds me of this whole journey is a picture of my family, 2006, 11 years after I lost it all, in front of the Magic Kingdom, and my daughter dressed as a princess. And I still keep that picture on my desk to this day because it reminds me that, you know, we can turn things around. And if I could, especially in the mental state where I was at, you guys certainly can. So that's part of the mindset. But let's talk a little bit more about the mindset, right? So, you know, and actually take a quick time out. I mean, you really need something like that that's going to motivate you. And I don't think it should just be one picture. You need things, whether it's pictures like the logos of the charities you want to support. I've had pictures of the guitars I want to buy, the cruises I want to take with my family. Heck, a few years ago, when I first started paying for college, now I'm paying for three at the same time, I had a picture of a dorm because that was part of the deal. I told my son, look, if you do well with your grades, we'll send you away for college. So you have to start at the local level. You do well. And you know what? You know, shame on me for having like a brainiac kid. He did really, really well. Dean's list and everything. So now I had to come through at my end of it. And those of you who have never paid for college and then all of a sudden you're writing checks, it's quite substantial. So that was another thing that kept me really, really motivated. But I really thought back on what it was that really screwed me over the first time around when I lost everything. I had mentioned to you guys that I was arrogant and like I was a know-it-all. And, you know, I just was this old dog. So I decided to take on a mentality that you guys hear me talk about a lot. But this is when I first came in contact with this concept of being a humble student. And of life, of sales, of, you know, whatever it is that you want to get better at, where everyone can be your teacher, where we're humble and we're not arrogant. And that is a big thing in sales because we have these egos. And many times the ego gets in the way of the lesson. So now there's more to this now. It gets more intense as we go, I promise you. So part of this was I had to learn to take my medicine and take feedback from people. And that was something that I was never good at because I had owned my own business and stuff. And, you know, I was good at it to an extent, but the bottom line was, I was the owner of the business. And if I wanted to, you know, tell a potential client to F off, I could. I didn't have to worry about the boss. You know, so it was like a different thing. But I'll never forget when I was sitting in kind of, you know, in the cubicles and the bullpen, if you will. And me and this other sales rep at that point in time were always the ones struggling on the team, right? I was still new and everything. And the guy that hired us, the guy who was running the office, he was a top performer, right? A continual President's Club winner and stuff. He was always like a top 20 rep. And he was like really old school, this guy. And by the way, he was younger than me, which was the first time in my life that I had somebody telling me what to do who was younger than me. So I had to kind of get over that too, as far as the mindset goes. He came into that room and I could see him you could see him plainly like listening to us. But he had this look on his face of just pure disgust, almost like, you know, like he was like smelling something bad in the room. He just looked like he was just like ready to throw up. And I knew it was because of whatever it was we were saying or not saying. And he motions to us to just kill the conversation, just hang on. And he's like, hang up, get him off the phone. And he's like really pissed off. And he says, I'm not condoning what he did, but I needed to get this ass kicking, right? This little dose of humility. He said, I'm going to go out on a limb and say that you guys aren't selling anything today, right? And he could even just look up the board and see like big goose eggs next to our name for that day. And he said, the reason why you guys aren't selling anything is because you sound so effing pathetic on the phone. And that, you know, again, for those of us with egos, and I'm not saying that was the right way to talk to people. And this is in the days where HR really didn't clamp down as much as today. It was like, it was pretty bad and pretty brutal. And, you know, what I really wanted to say to him when he said that to me, here I am, been through all these things, just some dude trying to put food on his table and make up for a really bad mistake he made the year before. And I got this guy talking shit like that. What I really wanted to say to him is, you know, you're a real dick. You know, that's what I really wanted to do. And then, you know, I don't know, maybe just, you know, like throw a few elbows at his nose or something. It just didn't sit well with me. But I took my medicine and I said, you know, tell us what is it that we're missing? And once I was able to get around just the sheer, just brutal delivery style that this guy had, I learned a valuable lesson. He said, you sound desperate. You sound hard up. You sound like that guy in the bar at 3 o'clock in the morning trying desperately to get laid. He said, it's just, I mean, I'm sorry, I'm being brutal here, guys, but this is what he said to me. It was a lot for me to handle. Again, remember, my self-esteem at that point wasn't really, you know, that good. Think about get like that moment we just got an ass kick, and we've all gotten our ass kicked, right, folks? I mean, you know, I can't be the only one here. You don't feel like, all right, now I'm going to conquer the world. You feel pretty shitty for a long period of time, especially when you get your ass kicked in the way I did. So I wasn't feeling too good, but I said, I need to take this medicine. I can't be that arrogant guy. I need to be the humble student. And I said to him, you know, what is it that's making us sound desperate? And he mentioned that, like, we were practically begging people and that we need to remember who we were representing. We were representing one of the top companies in the world. He said, you know, stop acting like the geek and the loser in the bar and, you know, start acting, you know, like the guy, like, who's got, like, everything, man. You know, so we just changed our attitudes. I know I did. And I wasn't arrogant. I remember he described it. He says, you need more of a quiet confidence. I mean, you know, if people aren't going to fulfill their promise with you, whatever it is, you know, keep in touch with them another time. But there's plenty of other people that want to do business with them, and screw them, man, you know. And so it was an attitude adjustment that I had to do right there. But like I said, I had to be able to take all forms of medicine, whether it was somebody having a polite heart-to-heart, whether it was customer feedback, or this brutal dude that I was working for. So that was the first thing. The other thing that I did in terms of taking my medicine came from the operations department. Now, you guys know that sales and operations traditionally clash. So the guy in the operations department sat down with me and he said, you know, I just want to give you some feedback. Some of these deals that you're bringing in are really not being estimated properly. You know, and he pointed out some things to me. And again, his delivery style wasn't the best, but this guy turned out to be one of my biggest advocates. And not only did he help me with his advice and counsel become a much better salesperson, even though he wasn't in sales, he also was really instrumental in helping me to rise to the top in the organization and run my own region. So he had mentioned to me, you know, you really should learn the other end of the business, Paul. He goes, you know, you had mentioned you were in printing and, you know, you really understood the manufacturing side because you were a pressman. And he said, this might seem beneath you. He said, but A, why don't you go through the training that our franchise owners go through? And B, why don't, it was a cleaning company, by the way. He said, and B, why don't you like actually get out there and clean so you know our process? And you know, you don't have to do this as a full-time job, but go out with a few of the crews so you understand what's involved in, you know, waxing a floor and carpet cleaning and some of these things that you're going to be trying to sell to someone. And I took my medicine and I did it. And it really taught me the other side of the business. And that to this day is one of those things that I utilize. I always try to learn the other side of the business, right? Because when we're being trained on something, many times it's in sales tactics, right? If you're in sales, many times it's on selling points and the company's value proposition and all that kind of stuff, how to overcome typical objections in that industry. But very rarely are we taught the other side, the technical side of it, because it's really, for the most part, a lot of people view it as unnecessary. So my advice is, if there are some lessons that maybe you can get from that other side by spending a little time in your factory and warehousing, distribution, whatever it is, accounting, and just kind of rotate around a little bit here and there. It doesn't have to take up your whole life. It can be very helpful. I know it helped me. So now, here comes a huge one that really, I mean, it was literally like pushing a fast forward button for me with results. The next thing that I decided to utilize was something called modeling. Now, I don't mean like modeling like in front of a camera. And those of you who've seen my looks, you know damn well that I don't mean modeling in front of a camera. But what I mean is modeling in terms of modeling behavior, right? And I remember reading several of, well, he didn't really have several books at that point, Tony Robbins. But I'd gone through his Personal Power Back then it was a cassette system. I had read actually two of his books by that point. And I remember Tony Robbins talking about modeling. When you see someone who is getting the results that you want, model that behavior. So what I did was I identified some people that I wanted to model. And it kind of goes back to that mindset thing that we talked about and having that attitude of humble student. And one of the hardest things for us to do in sales is to be vulnerable enough to ask someone for help. It's like, it's almost like guys and our need to avoid reading directions, right? Or asking for directions, right? Or reading instructions or whatever. So I was fortunate enough to have the number two rep worldwide working in my office. He was the sales manager. So, yeah, and by the way, he was another one who was not only brutal, but he was just a first-rate dick. He was just not somebody I'd want to go and hang out with. But I decided to stroke his ego. And I said, listen, man, you know, you've been number two, you're kicking ass, you know, I'm really fortunate to be working with a guy like you. Can I just kind of go out and shadow you and learn from you? You know, I could be kind of like your Daniel-san, right? And you could be my Miyagi. And I went out in the field with him. And very quickly, I could see what he was doing. He wasn't winning these deals with his personality. In fact, he had a personality that you could see the look on other people's faces was a little bit too aggressive for them. And he was like one of those hardcore closers. But still, he kicked ass consistently. So what I learned from him was that he used to bring this carry-on bag with him on every single appointment. And I said, hey, Tom, what, you know, what's in there? And he said, well, those are my props. And I go, what do you mean? He goes, well, you'll see. So when we would get to the point of the meeting where he would present our company and our solutions and how it would address the challenges people were having and all, he would use props to bring the intangible, and please write this down if you're not driving, because this is a huge takeaway that a lot of people in sales don't do. What he was doing is using props to put a tangible face on something that was normally intangible. So let me say it again. He used props to put a tangible type of face on things that were really intangibles, that people, they know the word, they appreciate the word, but really kind of like, well, what does that look like? So that these people could really visualize how kick-ass our services were. So I'll give you some examples. One of the things that we had was as a selling point was the amount of insurance that we carried. Now think about this. What does insurance look like, right? Like okay, it's insurance. I know what it is, but what Tom did as a prop, he showed them the actual certificate of insurance. Another selling point that we had was that we train the cleaning crews better than anyone else in the industry. So he didn't just say that. He told the story of what they went through in the training program. And as he told the story, he brought out the props. He would say, you know, well, first of all, you know, there's X amount of time in the classroom or whatever it is. We have these reinforcement videos, and he'd break out like the DVDs and put them out on the desk. Or back then, I think it was like, it was actual videos like VHS, man. So these huge videos, put them out on the desk. Then he would talk about how, you know, this training manual here is one of six different training manuals that they're going to have the entire time. And he'd pull out even the damn test that they had to take at the end of the program. So he'd have those out. Then when it came to our quality control, right, which again is intangible, how do you make that tangible? He said, you know, here's a sampling of six of the internal forms that we use to ensure that you don't have to babysit us. So he had this, and the way that he described it to me, which I thought was great, he said, Paul, you ever see those infomercials where, like, as they're going along, they're putting out all the things you get for the $99.99? You get the DVDs, you get the manual, you get the Ginsu knives. He said, at the end of that presentation, he goes, I want it to be like an infomercial where they're looking at a whole desk full of shit that they're going to be getting with this, and things that normally they would not visualize. We want to tell the story better than anyone else in industry. So what I did now is I modeled Tom. And I took it a step further, being the humble student. So I love that idea. I started doing it. I started closing more business instantly. So what I did on top of that was I took Tom's idea of the prompt and I turned it into my concept of laying a landmine. This is when I first started utilizing that concept. A landmine is something that you leave behind for your competitors to basically disqualify them and have your prospect look at them differently. And it's not bad mouthing. It's educating your client on the questions they need to be asking to make a better decision. So let's take this concept of the insurance form that I mentioned that Tom would show. I did the same thing that Tom did. I showed that insurance form. And I said, oh, by the way, you had mentioned to me you're getting two other bids. One of the little tricks in this business is people show you a certificate of insurance that basically was expired about a year or two before. Most companies, when they go through financial hardships, the first thing to go is insurance. So number one, you need to ask if you could take a look at it, make sure that it is dated currently, and tell them as part of the process, you need in the proposal a current validated certificate of insurance. See, things like that that I would do would knock out my competitors. It was a landmine. But I'd also say you also need to make sure that they have a minimum of $15 million worth of insurance. Now, I knew that was a good number to give people because we found that our average competitor only had about $5 million. We actually had $30 million. So I said the next thing you want to do is make sure you look on here and make sure there's at least $15 million worth of insurance. And I gave them a strong, compelling why. And the why behind it is I said, unfortunately, you and I are living in a world where I can hurt your feelings and you can sue me for millions of dollars. Imagine now somebody has a slip and fall from a wet floor from the cleaning crew. How much do you think that they can sue you for? And by the way, if there's not enough insurance, now they go after you. You're liable for that. So again, I took this concept of taking intangibles, making them tangible with the props, which was Tom's technique. And then I went and married it into my style, which was then turning it into a landmine, making this part of the criteria. I wanted to be the person who was whispering in the prospect's ear saying, here's how you buy this service properly. Because when you face it, folks, most people are not really, really good at buying your product or service. They'd like to think that they are. But see, you know all, like almost like the people who have like, you know, like used to cheat Vegas and then they show the cops how people are cheating Vegas. Well, that's kind of the position we're in. We know the things, right? Not from having cheated people, but we know the areas that other companies fall short. So without bad-mouthing, we want to educate people on questions they should be asking, on things that they need to insist on from a potential relationship. So the next thing that I did, right? Now, we were talking about this whole modeling thing. Let me tell you something else that I decided to model. I met the number one sales rep. So far, I met the second best. I, at this point now, I rose up in the ranks. And now I'm like hovering around 60th, like forever, right? I'm like stuck right in there, 60th. I qualify for a convention, and lo and behold, there is the number one sales rep that was number one 2 years in a row shooting pool, right? And we're in this like bar type of place after all the meetings. You know, that's the best part of the conventions, having the beers with your peers, right? Beers with peers. And I'm going to trademark that. And but it goes back to this attitude thing. You had to hear the other sales reps. They were almost like even like criticizing him physically. Look, that's our number one sales rep. And it's like everybody was so threatened by this guy. And I remember getting up and people were like, well, where are you going? I'm like, I'm going to buy him a beer, man. If he was number one 2 years in a row, I can learn something from him for the price of a beer. So I buy him a beer, shake his hand, man. He, you know, he's done with his pool game by now. And he tells me his secret. And you can tell that I was obviously not the first person. But he, before I tell you what he told me, I need to tell you how he prefaced, because I think this might be many of you out there. He said, Paul, you know, a lot of people come to me and they're expecting some major, like, gold nugget, right? Like some revelation to sales. He goes, what I'm going to tell you is not sexy in any way, shape, or form. It's not some big, you know, incredible answer. And that's where I get worried about people, he said, because it's not sexy enough, or like the answer, you go, oh my God, I've never heard that. That is brilliant. You might want to dismiss it. And he said, you know, I don't know you at this point. We've only had a few sips of beer together, he says, but I hope you're the person who actually takes this piece of advice I'm about to give. So first of all, that's a little nugget for you guys. I mean, don't always be looking for the big answer. I found in my 34 years now in sales is that many times it's a lot of little answers that everybody neglects because they're looking for the big answer. So here was his answer, and I got to tell you, I don't know why. Maybe he was trying to set the bar low or something. I actually thought this was pretty freaking brilliant, what he said to me. So I don't know why he thought it wasn't anything but brilliant. But he said, what I do, every appointment that I go on, I ask for a referral. And I said, so what do you mean? Like once they become a client, you go back, you're doing a service call? He goes, no, no. He goes, I'm talking about like the first time I meet them. You know, we will meet for 20 or 30 minutes. I'll ask them for a referral. And he looks, and he was very good, I guess, at reading body language. He goes, see, that's what I'm talking about. You're looking at it. And he goes, he said, you also might be a little uncomfortable. And I said, well, that's an understatement. I would be very uncomfortable asking someone who hasn't even experienced our service to recommend us, right? Or to refer us or give us names of people, whatever it is. And he said, I haven't been thrown out any place yet, Paul. And he goes, that is the secret. He goes, nobody wants to try it. He goes, let me ask you a question. He goes, do you have the balls to pick up the phone and cold call somebody? I go, yep. I said, if I didn't cold call people, I wouldn't be 60th right now. I'd still be up around like, you know, like 3:30 out of 3:45 or whatever. He goes, right. And he goes, well, that's a lot harder than asking a person at the end of 30 minutes, hey, by the way, would you know of anyone else who might be interested in this particular service? And he said, I want to remind you, I haven't been thrown out of any place yet. No, he goes, trust me, that is not going to be the worst thing that anybody has ever said to them if you really think about it. And, you know, and he even like, you know, had some fun with me. He goes, you live in New York, for God's sakes. He goes, you guys are giving each other the finger like, you know, as greeting out there. He goes, I can't imagine that this would offend anybody. So I started doing this. So my goal was that, you know, we were running probably 3 appointments a day back then. And my goal was to generate 1 to 2 additional appointments at the end of every day, whether it be for the future or not. So I would take the 3 and I would turn it into approximately 5, sometimes 6. And I did this every single day because, you know, they say sales is a numbers game, right? So I was able then to take that success I was having and then just kind of magnify it by doing more of something, right? And in this case, I wasn't even doing it at all, but I just figured, well, more of something. I want to create more appointments. So here's how I could fast forward it. And that one piece of advice, just so you know, took me from 60th to 12th worldwide. And it stopped there at 12th worldwide for me. And you might be thinking, well, you know, I mean, you're making like, you made this incredible comeback. First of all, 60th to 12th is a really big comeback, especially when you just got your ass handed to you the year before. But I was promoted after that. So I'm sure I could have went on. But so that's one of the things that I learned from him. Here's the next thing that, again, if you're not driving, I want you to jot this down. Everything that I learned, I tried to take to the next level. So what I learned here is not just the fact that, well, if I ask people for referrals, even if they're not doing business with me, or like from Tom, if I use props and make the intangible tangible, what I did was I said, okay, wait a minute. This was brilliant because I learned from the number two sales rep and modeled that person. I learned from the number one sales rep and modeled that person. How do I take that tactic and magnify that? And just like, instead of talking to two people, how do I speak with 20 or 30 or 40 or 50 people? So what I did was, and I did this for many years after this with other companies I worked for and even with, is I said, okay, we've got 375 sales reps. What I'm going to do is every single week, I'm going to call a successful rep. So I was always following the rankings because I was very competitive. So what I would do is, like, let's just say I'm ranked 60th. I would look at the people in the top 50 and I would set my sights on them. Obviously, they're doing something better than me. They're ranked higher. They're making more money than me. I want to find out what it is that they're doing. And what I learned also that you have to do when you're speaking with people and you want them to explain something to you, what I learned is the average person doesn't really know how to break things down. They're just so used to doing it at an awesome level that they don't really break it down and deconstruct how they became awesome. So that's when I had to almost be like an interviewer, right? Like an interview host, and help them break things down. So what I would do is I would call them and I would say, you know, I would have this format. Right. And this was a while ago, so I'm probably going to be rusty, but I would like start at the beginning of the sales call and say, take me through your needs analysis. How is it that you like, what are the questions that you're asking? Are there any special questions that you've kind of revised over the years or whatever it is? Okay. When it comes time to present our company story, how is it that you're doing it? Take me through that. When it comes time to close, how do you ask for the business? How do you overcome objections? Right. So I would just take every part of it, and I got it down where I could have these conversations in about 15 minutes. So that's something that you should be doing, by the way. And one of the things that I learned during this time, there was a lot of things, but again, I want to try to give you guys some really specific tactics that really accelerated my success and ones that I teach my coaching clients that work well for them. So in one of these conversations, and I was like jotting this all down in my journal, I had so many nuggets, like gold nuggets of ideas and tactics. One of them that really stood out was this tactic called concerns and solutions. So one of the reps that I interviewed said that when it comes time to present our story and I'm presenting the proposal that we've prepared for them, I prepare a document that is set aside from the actual proposal. And I call it concerns and solutions. It's one side of an 8.5-11 sheet of paper. And I list one by one whatever concerns they said to me. So this was the cleaning industry. So they might say, you know, poor bathroom cleaning. And then what they do in solution, they would just give a brief overview of how we could address that so that they would not have that problem again. Bad kitchen area, whatever it is, concern. And then we would talk about what the solution would be. And what I found in using this was that when you do this, I would have like a little highlighter marker and I'd say, well, one of the things, Mary, that you said to me is that you're very concerned about this. And I would highlight it. Here's how we would address it before I get into the proposal. Also, you had this concern right here. And I would take them through how we would address it. And I would get confirmation as we went along. Number one, did I hear you properly? Yes. How do you think that would address it, you know, from your perspective? Do you think that would cut it? And I would have them really vested in this before I ever went through the formality of a proposal. So, and what was really cool about it is that sometimes I would miss the mark because I'm human. And if I miss the mark, I would say, well, then this proposal is not going to work. I need to go back and give you something that's even better. So if you don't mind, I'm going to go back to the drawing board and I'm going to come back within 24 hours and we're going to keep doing this until we nail us to the point that you wish you hired me 5 years ago. So that was one of the other things that I picked up. But seriously, I had to have picked up like 30 or 40 different gold nuggets that each one of them helped at different parts of the sales cycle. But I never would have gotten that far if I didn't have the mindset of humble student. Heck, I was even talking to people that, like, I was like 60th and 50th and, like, you know, I'm going up in the rankings. I was even talking to people that rank like 100th and 90th and stuff, because my theory was that we can learn from everyone. Next. This one was a huge one for me, and this is one that I just, like, stumbled on my own, and I've been teaching it to people ever since. I started to use analogies in my presentations. Analogies are wonderful things to use, especially when you need someone to understand something. It kind of bridges the known with the unknown. It's a very nice way, too, of dumbing something down. So in our case, we were so used to saying something in all the conventions, all the sales meetings. They practically beat us to death with this one thing that we were supposed to really sell, and it was called the franchise concept. And my theory was, well, we get it. And we talk to people like they get it too. But I'm getting these, like, you know, like somebody tilts their head at you when they don't understand what you're talking about. I was getting lots of those. And I know I was explaining it well, but not well enough. So I needed something to help them connect the dots. So the whole concept, just so you guys know, of the franchise concept that we were pushing was that instead of an employee making a few bucks an hour, you were getting a business owner. So I felt that, you know what, an analogy will really drive this point home to the point where the recipient of the message owns the message, that they're nodding their head going, oh, shit, man, that makes, like, great sense, right? Sign me up. So what I started doing, and then when I ran my own region, I taught all my sales reps to do this, is I created an analogy, and the analogy was a rented car, right, a rental. And I would say, do you ever rent a car? And they'd say, sure. And I said, let me ask you a question, and it's not a trick question. Before you'd bring the car back, did you get it detailed and washed wax and you know, check the oil and give it a tune-up, maybe rotate the tires? And they'd look at me funny and say, again, it's not a trick question. I'm dead serious. And they go, of course not. And I go, well, why not? And they said, because, oh, hello, it's not mine. I rented it. And I go, and that right there is the difference. Because I bet with your car, though, right, you get it washed and waxed and you get it tuned up and serviced, right? Because it's yours. You own it. You take care of it as if it is yours. Why? Because it is. Well, there's a difference. And the difference is that the people that we would be putting into your organization are business owners. They're going to treat your account like it's theirs because it is. Who do you think is going to work harder for you, Mr. Customer? The person who owns and has a vested interest in the success, or an hourly employee? Who would you rather trust your keys to after hours? The person who's hourly, or the person who owns a franchise and who has invested in this business, a business owner? And it went over just incredibly well, right? An analogy. So I want you to think about that too. Where could you use analogies in your presentation? And analogies are forms of evidence that kind of remove doubt and eliminate the probability of doubt and skepticism and objections and things like that. So that's one of the things that you want to do. And really, the final thing that I want to talk about for now, because there's really so many things that I did, I really wanted to touch on the main things. The other thing was that I reinvested a portion. And in the beginning, it had to be a small portion because I wasn't making a lot. It was $19,000 at that point and hardly any commission until I got ramped up. But I reinvested a portion of my commissions into getting smarter in sales. So, and it was also getting smarter at sales and sales-related things. So I would back then, it was like you'd go to like a brick-and-mortar bookstore. So I'd go to the bookstore. I'd buy a book. I mean, back then it was like 10 bucks. I mean, even though I was tight on money, I realized that seriously, I would have to like seriously not take action on that book to not make back 10 bucks. I mean, my average take on a deal was a hell of a lot more than 10 bucks. So I figured, I mean, it's like half a deal and I've made, you know, like 10 times to 20 times that amount back on a shitty day. So to me, it was a no-brainer that I did that. So I started doing that. Back then, it really wasn't like CDs and MP3s. I would buy cassettes. And as I started making more money, I started investing more in myself. When I started getting ranked up around like 100th and 90th, my paycheck was really going up. So I would take like seminars back then, I remember. I took a course at one of the local companies that was out here and stuff. I remember going in and like having to save my money and going in with a bunch of other coworkers to see Tony Robbins in New York City and things like that. And then I did sales-related things. And what I mean by that, things that would be like tools that would help me in sales. So whether it was like maybe investing in nicer clothes and nicer shoes. And you know, I didn't have much of a wardrobe when I first started it because I was pretty freaking poor. So things like that. I remember investing in a tape recorder. And the reason why is because one of the people, when I said call a successful rep, one of the people I kind of interviewed said, you know what I do, Paul? Every appointment that I go on, while I'm driving there, I do a drive-by. And I'm like, that's sick, man. It's like a drive-by. What do you, like point your gun sideways and, you know, like open up, you know, open fire on? Like, what the hell is that? And he goes, no, drive-by is as I'm going by, I just like kind of jot down on my tape recorder the names of the businesses in the area so that when I get back to the office, I'll call them because, you know, I'm passing all this money on my way to go make other money. So to me, I want to just have as many opportunities as I can. So I needed to like go buy it. Back then, it was a tape recorder and go do that. So it's like that. But investing in myself back then and even now is a very important thing. Because it reminds me that I'm always going to be that humble student. See, I don't want to stop being that humble student because the minute I do, first of all, I'm a little superstitious. I really feel like I failed the first time around because I was arrogant and I wasn't humble in my learning. I felt I knew it all. So I don't want that to ever happen again and put my family through what I did. But also, it's a matter of, you know, I don't want to ever stop learning because I think when we get into those periods of time, things get very stale and it becomes very boring. So I really don't know that I want to live in a world where I figured it all out. Part of what gets me up in the morning is knowing that I have this incredible mystery called life and this incredible learning opportunity called life and business or whatever you want to call it. So I really don't want to go through my career feeling like I got it all figured out. I mean, it's very boring. And for those of you who really are not embracing that humble student mentality, I'm telling you, you're missing out on just a sense of well-being that you haven't experienced yet. And I think it's very, very important. And I think there's two sides of it. I think, and back then, there wasn't a heck of a lot of free stuff like today, where you have like this right now. This is free. This podcast you're listening to, and my blog is free, and all these other things out there, and there's free PDFs you can download and all that. So there's that side of it. By all means, do that. But I'm here to tell you that you need to have some skin in the game because I will tell you, and I will argue this to the day that I die, that you will value things at a much higher level that you've invested your own hard-earned money in. And that's why I'm not a huge advocate of your boss paying for things. This is why like I get like a little shitty when I hear somebody saying, yeah, I'm not going to – I don't read books because my boss won't reimburse me for that. And I'm like, you cheap bastard. Like you couldn't drop $15 or $20 because you know your boss isn't going to reimburse you for that. But – you know, I've known you for a while. I know that you're a Starbucks addict. And you know, I mean, those things cost like, what, $5, $6 a day? Out here in New York, you know, we have these delis where you go and you get egg sandwiches. I know that you're getting egg sandwiches all the time. You're a cigar smoker like me. You don't smoke the cheap shit. You're smoking the expensive stuff. You take God knows how many vacations a year. But you can't fork over the dough for like a $15 book. I mean, sometimes we really have to stop and say, yeah, that's just like asinine. And we have to get back to that humble student thing. So two sides of that humble student thing is the side where, yes, absorb the free stuff. But the other side, I think you need to tell your brain that you're taking this seriously enough to like put the money and invest in. I mean, you invest – in strange foreign companies with your 401k. And yet, what you're basically telling your brain, but I won't invest in you because, you know, even though you're the surest thing on the planet, I'm not going to invest in you. I'm going to instead, I'm going to go and invest in that company like overseas because I believe more in that than myself. So there you have it, folks. I mean, again, no rocket science here. I don't know that you went through this podcast saying, oh, my God, that's the most brilliant thing in the world. But what's really important here is, number one, that you become the humble student. Number two, that you take action on these things and kind of look at sales as your personal laboratory where you're going to try things. And you're not going to sit there and get all kinds of butt hurt every time you like fall on your face and you make a mistake because things aren't going to work perfectly every single time. But I think you'll find that the people who have been most successful in business and in sales and in life are the people who like keep getting up, not just for the sake of getting up, by the way. To me, that's like, you know, like almost like you're becoming a professional punching bag at that point. I mean people who like get up and understand, okay, here's what happened that got me like to the point where I got knocked on my ass to begin with. And, you know, there's actually an opportunity here that I could have been leveraging that I wasn't, that you're continually learning and modeling other people who are getting the results that you want. And many of you listening to this, you work for companies where you have sales reps that you could be calling them and just finding out how they do things. And just think about your process that you follow in your company, whatever that order is, and just kind of informally go down that list with them. Okay, how do you go about this? Tell me about some of the questions that you're asking. You know, is there anything you do, like as far as like rapport and credibility, negotiation? Whatever. How is it that, you know, like I told you guys, that company I worked for, we had the franchise concept. And maybe you have your own equivalent, right? Maybe you just like call it the value proposition, whatever it is. How do you go about communicating our value proposition? Do you have a different way of saying it? I'm curious. Is there anything that you do to kind of explain parts of this that maybe are a little confusing? Like I've always found this part of it confusing. People look at me weird. What, are you doing anything there that might like I might be able to learn from? And like, don't just sit there and take notes. Get out there and do that. I mean, did you? You know, it's so funny. And then I'm going to wrap up because I feel like at this point I'm just rambling with you guys, just like hanging out and visiting, just like spewing nonsense. But there is this saying, and it's called, like, don't be an ask-hole. Don't be an ask-hole. An ask-hole is a person who asks you for advice and then proceeds not to follow it and do whatever the hell they want. That, you know, and sometimes people do that because they think that what they're doing is flattering you and that you're going to be so flattered that they ask for your opinion and everything else. But then there's people like me. It's like, you just wasted my time. I wasn't keeping a scorecard until you just completely, you know, it became apparent to me that you just thought that you were stroking my ego by asking me for my opinion, and you had no intention of following my advice. You just wasted my time. And therefore, the next time you call me for advice, I'm going to tell you to piss off. So you don't want to do that either. I mean, my feeling is that part of this humble student thing is not like just taking medicine and asking people for help and being vulnerable enough to ask for their opinion and feedback and everything. It's actually having the balls to go out there and try it. So you got a lot to think about today. And before you go, I want to remind you, and if you remember part of what I learned here when I was modeling the number two rep worldwide was how he was asking for referrals. We're actually going to be talking about this whole business of referrals and how to – I have a few ideas, more than a few ideas, probably about 20 or 25 ideas that several of them can easily double and triple the amounts of referrals that you're getting. And you know what they say about referrals, man? It is like the lowest hanging of the low hanging fruit. So if you'd like to learn more, we're going to be doing this on April 6th at 11:30 a.m. Eastern Time. The name of the webinar is How to Explode Your Sales by Generating More Referrals. So how to explode your sales by generating more referrals. You can learn more by visiting yoursalesplaybook.com/referrals, yoursalesplaybook.com/referrals. With that, I'm Paul Castain from yoursalesplaybook.com. I am wishing you an incredible week ahead. Go get them. The Sales Playbook Podcast is a Castain Training Systems production. Visit us at www.yoursalesplaybook.com.